Next case is 97-2435, Ritchie Produce Company versus State of Ohio Department.
Yeah, it's right in there. Everybody came to hear them too. No, I think we've got a lot of people here. We turn it.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
We should put that in all these lawyers in without taking a test that does it. I know you're conscientious, objective, compassionate person, but you're getting these people in every week.
That's right. If we were to hold that Mr. Ritchie is not a member of the protected class, do we need to get the constitutional issue? Is that the end of the issue? Right.
That's not the end of the case, Your Honor. First of all, state commission, Mr. Ritchie is not a member. A jury examiner looked at all of the evidence in this case. The first in the Ohio Administrative Code, the DASS rule, for the definition of what is financial, and very precisely determined that he, in fact, is not financial. Just one of that scenario, the constitutional company is affiliated to. But even if this court were to determine that it is financial and therefore is a person program, the state, the court still must take the constitutional question. There still be a controversy between each party as to whether this court, whether the program can in fact consider his race at all. Mr. Ritchie himself is arguing that his race is in fact irrelevant, that the program he seeks to be a part of and the program that he thinks the court to develop is one that takes into consideration only economic disadvantages, not race.
That requires them to actually rewrite the statute to put words in there that Mr. Ritchie did here and make it possible.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that you do. That, in fact, the judicial legislating, which apparently both of the law reforms engaged in. In this case, it is particularly contrary to the legislation. The original legislation that is House Bill 584, when it was originally enacted in 1980, specifically said that in order to be an entity, you have to be a member of an economically disadvantaged group, including but not limited to the four named groups. It wasn't until 1981 when the legislature changed the language to say that you had to be a member of one of the following four disadvantaged groups. So what Mr. Ritchie is asking, what the lower court did, was judicially legislate out that amendment in 1981.
If we find the MBE program, in fact, is not unconstitutional, does that in any way conflict with the recent finding of the Federal District Court?
It depends, Your Honor. What Judge Graham did was so specifically the state construction contract. So to the extent that you would rule on both state purchasing and state construction, it would in fact be in conflict.
Then who sets the final ground rules with regard to that if we do it under our state constitution?
It may in fact be your honor in the United States Supreme Court if we are left with a conflict between the state and the federal court in this instance. In fact, one of the arguments of the state of Ohio made to Judge Graham was that he could abstain from ruling on that decision in order to give this court the opportunity to make a ruling in this case first.
Are you arguing for the position that it is constitutional and thereby bringing us in conflict with the federal case?
Well, Your Honor, it's not decided to be in conflict with the federal decision, but that is in fact our position here today, that this statute is in fact constitutional in order to defend.
I mean, there is no other way to do it. If we find it constitutional, it conflicts, doesn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, I think it does.
It could be argued that an opinion of the state Supreme Court supersedes an opinion of a federal district court. But you don't need to respond to that, but that's another argument.
I would certainly accept that, Your Honor. One thing that we all agree on here today is the standard of review. Certainly the dozens of courts from around the country have looked at similar questions to determine that the standard of strictly does apply. That requires the court to look at a two-part test. First, is there a compelling state interest? Is there a compelling state interest in addressing discrimination, and that is state-sponsored discrimination? But secondly, is the law that was enacted narrowly tailored in order to redress that discrimination? Both of those elements are met here. If you look at the history of the legislation that was before the General Assembly in 1980, it becomes very clear that the state had a firm basis in evidence in which to enact House Bill 584. In 1980, there was before a long history of judicial, executive, and administrative findings supporting the fact that the state, that not only does discrimination exist within state contracting, but that the state has in some way been a sponsor or a joint participant in that discrimination.
That seemed to be the point on which Judge Graham found this legislation to fail the strict scrutiny test with regard to compelling interest. The Court of Appeals, in our case, really didn't even address that point, did it? It went right to the next narrowly tailored test and found it lacking there.
That is true, Your Honor. Both courts had available to them, however, the Kite decision. I recognize very clearly that Kite was decided before Croson in 1989. However, it is extremely instructive to show, as a factual matter, what was before the legislature in 1980 when it enacted the legislation. Judge Canary's decision is quite detailed in the testimony that was before him at the time, and the Sixth Circuit was equally detailed in their analysis of the actual firm basis and evidence that was in front of the legislature in 1980.
Was Judge Graham determining the exact same legislation as we're looking at here?
That's a difficult question to answer, Your Honor. First of all, the case that was before Judge Graham only went to state construction contracts.
That's what I thought.
It was challenged to the Steel Prison Project and a minority set aside for the purpose of a construction contract. Therefore, hearing specifically, by Code 123.151, which gives a 5% minority set aside and a 7% subcontracting requirement to state construction contracts. He did not consider very significantly evidence that might be a purchasing contract, which arrived, of course, out of 125.081, which is how Mr. Ritchie received his contract in this case.
That's the way I read the two cases, and it seems to me on that basis the federal case could be distinguished if you were inclined to do so.
I certainly think that it could be distinguished, Your Honor. We have the benefit first of Judge Graham's bench ruling, which seems to be a bit broader. And as Justice Cook mentioned, it seems to go back to House Bill 584 and the analysis that Judge Canary and the Sixth Circuit used in the Kite decision. However, in looking at the written order is very narrow and goes specifically to Revised Code 123.151, as I mentioned, which is for the purposes of state construction contracts. So on that ground, Your Honor, could in fact be distinguished.
Now, how does the statute of six groups that we have to show that this is both narrowly tailored and this compelling state interest? Would you address those issues?
I'd be happy to. Thank you, Your Honor. The compelling state interest really goes to whether the state, in fact, has a firm basis in evidence. The firm basis in evidence was being established very quickly beginning in at least 1957, when a decision by the Federal District Court found in Eckerd v. Rose that the state had shown a shocking concerns or the discrimination that was occurring in the state construction contract here at the time, and actually it's been a joint participant in that discrimination. Governor Gilligan followed up that decision in 72 and 73 executive order that took race neutral measures to address discrimination. And then we have decisions in the later 70s that also went along with the Attorney General's Task Force report in 1979 that relied not only on statistical data being provided to the legislature, but also anecdotal evidence that discrimination was still occurring in state contracting at that time. That backdrop is what the Ohio General Assembly used in 1980 to enact the legislation as it did. But as you mentioned, Your Honor, there is a second part of that, and that is whether it is in fact narrowly tailored. Whether it is in fact narrowly tailored to address the discrimination that is found. And in this case, the law is very narrowly tailored. Of course, generally, we look to the factors that have been outlined by the United States Supreme Court in United States versus Paradise. Those factors are the following. First, there has to be a necessity for the relief. Would alternative remedies be useful? Would alternative remedies be effective? In this case, the response they were shown very clearly by judicial decisions, by executive orders, not to have been effective. In fact, as I mentioned, the Edwards v. Rose case was the first in mind that the Civil Rights Commission in particular had been inadequate and ineffective. The second criteria is whether the remedies are flexible and they look particularly to the duration of the relief. In this case, the Ohio MDT program operates in a very flexible manner. As I said, there are two different set-aside provisions. One is the 5% set-aside for state construction contracts, which includes a 7% subcontracting requirement for any majority contracts that are left. There is a set-aside review board in place that allows a waiver if a contractor cannot meet that 7% subcontracting requirement. Statistics that are before this court in this record today show that virtually in every decision, the set-aside review board has a query that it very rarely denies those requests for waiver. In the instance of the 15% set-aside requirement for purchasing, the concept of waiver is not really applicable. There is a state agency that's required to set aside 15% of its contract. The concept of flexibility, however, is very clear when you look at the statistics of the percentages of what the state agencies have actually been setting aside. And over the past 10 years or so, in no year has an aggregate of the state set aside met its 15% goal. In many cases, it is around 9%, and I think the highest for the last 10 years or so is 13.7. There is no penalty against the state agency if they do not meet that percentage, and on a year-to-year basis, it is quite flexible as to whether it is met at all. They had court decisions that specifically identified the four minority groups against whom discrimination had occurred. They determined that these are the four groups that needed to have preferences given to them. If you were to broaden that to an economic or socially disadvantaged business under this program, then in fact you have the minority groups for which these benefits would go. That's not to suggest the state could not have a different program in place. Certainly the state of Ohio has, executive order developed a socially and regionalized citizens program that does look to socially and economically disadvantaged. That is a different program under a different standard, and that is not to suggest that a minority business program that looks at race per se and uses race per se classifications cannot also be valid and not be used in parallel with those other programs.
On that very issue, if the federal judgment is accepted on its face, as being the law. Is there any way to correct this, what some believe, including me, this systemic discrimination? Is there any way to correct that under the federal decision?
Your Honor, it's extremely difficult whenever you have a minority business program or a set-aside program in place. It's virtually impossible for a state to show at that moment that there is, in fact, discrimination occurring. There was certainly evidence before Judge Graham that showed that the competitive bidding process itself is quite fair, but that doesn't go to the question of whether there is discrimination in other methods by other methods that might be occurring. So Your Honor is correct that it becomes a very, if not very difficult, if not impossible standard for a court to meet. And we would almost have to invalidate the entire program, let it lie idle for a while, and after that period of time see if discrimination has in fact occurred while the program was.
We already have that history. That's in the record.
We did, Your Honor, and we didn't know until 1980 that was exactly the situation that the General Assembly was responding to when it enacted House Bill 584. I think my time is just about up. I'd like to reserve more time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. French. Mr. Liggett.
Good morning. I have with me today Mr. Ritchie and my co-counsel, Larry Page. The state makes this issue very difficult. There's a very easy solution to this: not legislating, not repealing the program, and reconciling with Judge Graham's opinion. Because the simple issue here, if the state glosses over, is whether the state administrator violated Mr. Ritchie's civil rights when they decertified him after receiving a call from a friend. That is in the record. Mr. Ritchie was certified as an Oriental, qualified as an economically disadvantaged business in 1990. For 5 years he was certified. In 1995 he was given a $2 million contract by the very agency who did the certification.
So you don't have any problem at all with the program and the legislation so long as he's included?
Your Honor, no one at the lower level, neither Mr. Ritchie nor the state, ever challenged the compelling governmental interest.
That was the reason for my question to Ms. French. That if we find that Mr. Ritchie is not a member of the protected class, where are we? Where is the constitutional issue?
It is still that they violated his civil rights by removing the certification.
But it's a different constitutional issue. It's not the issue of whether this program violates the Constitution by narrow tailoring and so forth.
It is narrow tailoring, but it's not compelling interest. Judge Graham's opinion solely deals with the compelling interest predicate. This case has absolutely nothing in either the argument or record dealing with that issue. The sole issue is a narrow tailoring point. And the Court of Appeals very articulately points out that the way this current administrator administers the program, distinguished from the predecessor, is both overbroad and underbroad at the same time. Now, I would point out that the statute in which they're operating under, by definition, 122.71, was never discussed by Judge Grant. That definition has defined what an economically disadvantaged individual is. It says it right in the statute. That's why we don't need to legislate. And then it holds that black, Hispanic, Oriental, American Indian qualify. Now, ODOT is the same. I've never come to a statute. That's never been challenged because they follow the federal guidelines, which were affirmed in Adirond Constructors. And what does Adirond say? Adirond makes a very articulate point cited in the state brief that says that we are not banned from, I'll read the syllabus, government is not disqualified from acting in response to the unhappy persistence of both the practice and the lingering effects of racial discrimination against minority groups in this country. The problem is the program that was fine, but Mr. Booker Hall, when he was the administrator, he certified Mr. Ritchie, and this is also in the record, one testimony, that he applied it as an economic disadvantage test, and that he used these racial categories merely for administrative categorization and for presumption. And that was the basis, for instance, in which Mr. Saul had included the Egyptian company as an Afro-American. That's in the record as well. What changed was this administrator, after handing him a contract that for 5 years saying he is economically disadvantaged and classified as a Marine, they did an about face because they got a call from the news.
The only way for you to win, if we follow the Court of Appeals decision, is to find the statute unconstitutional.
No, Your Honor, it's to find the action of the administrator in reversing the consistent state action and certifying him. She reversed that decision arbitrarily with no factor or law change.
No, I said if we follow the Court of Appeals opinion. Because the Court of Appeals opinion also found, did it not, that he's not an Oriental.
No, it did not. The Court of Appeals decision did not reach that decision because they found it on a constitutional issue that, in fact, his civil rights were violated. And it was just Hayek.
Well, the dissent reached it.
Yeah, the dissent said, well, we shouldn't do the constitutional issue, we should do it on Oriental. But the majority of the opinion said, no, we don't reach the Oriental issue. Our proposition of law is as follows. Mr. Ritchie's civil rights were violated when you use race per se, not as a presumption, but within...
What civil rights? Let's be specific.
Specifically, the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments applying that...
Equal protection.
Equal protection.
And what else?
And it's the 13th Amendment that applies to the state. You cannot discriminate by race. And that is the key. The state admitted in the Court of Appeals that if we raise this example, if Honda of America is shown to be owned 51% by Japanese, under Ohio's today administration, they're qualified as an MBE.
We may discriminate in this country on the basis of race where it's, and where we meet the strict scrutiny test.
But that is two pieces. One, they're true telling you.
Right.
And two, the remedy is narrowly tailored. On the other hand, the United States Supreme Court has already ruled on this very issue that if you use race only as a presumption of disadvantage, okay, I'm again, but we can show they're not truly disadvantaged. And the non-majority is out, so we can show he's the disadvantage, he can come in. That saves the statute, that saves the constitutionality. That's already written in the statute, because it says economically disadvantaged. That's the way Mr. Paul administered the statute until this administrator reversed herself. So,
I'm sorry. Just one more. You keep trying to make a second argument that if we were not to find the statute unconstitutional, either on the basis of not being narrowly tailoring or compelling state interest, you say your client has another civil rights, whatever that is, basis. What is that?
It is that he was discriminated against. And his rights were violated by the
under what statutes or what constitutional section are you saying that he has a right to continue in a program where he wasn't eligible in the first place?
That's not the issue.
All right.
He was discriminated against on a basis solely on the basis of race, which is prohibited by the 13th Amendment, applied to the state by the 14th and 5th.
That's really simplistic, counsel. You know that it's not okay, thank you.
And it is the action of the administrator who admits that it is the sole basis for these certifications that you use. It is not a presumption. It is an automatic, you're not black, you're not Arab, you're out. Now, the second part of our argument is even if you find that the statute is constitutional and that they may apply the regular and the presumption, which I believe is legal, constitutional, and upheld by Everett. The second proposition is that this jury is qualified as a Marine. Why? The legislature has made no distinction as to why the Japanese is in, but when an Asian Indian is not. And the appellate court has already held Asian Indians are included, even though that's not what the statute says, because the definitions are so vague. And what the trial court found, and I believe this can come in, unless there is to the narrow tailoring, this administration must define Oriental to be inclusive. It must define black to be inclusive.
Couldn't you just do it on statutory construction as opposed to a constitutional argument and find economic deprivation?
We could, but we believe if, in fact, the administration is going to use Oriental as presumption, we should be presumed in and let them prove that he is not disadvantaged, because the Oriental is not defined, and we see, now the Asian Indian is in, and the trial court, I think, is very perceptive in citing.
Not all of that, but it seems like you have started with two or three tabs under which you do
But I also think it's important to say the statute has the way it was administered.
I would back you up. If I understand what you're using, Honda, for example, you're saying that really the statute is to be applied to those who are disadvantaged economically and are. So Honda's out because they're not economically disadvantaged.
If proven that they were 51% owned by Japanese, they would be presumed in, but then disqualified under the economy.
All right. But I thought at the time you were using that example, you went on to say that your client's in because he's economically disadvantaged, even if he's not organized.
No, he would be in as well under the presumption, just as Honda would be, because he is oriental, in that the definition are against racist.
It's so the trade-off to him being in is that he has to be defined as oriental.
No, he could either be defined as oriental and presumed in, or he would be not oriental, but still able to get in if he can show economic disadvantage. And that would apply to any of
them. Even though the statute doesn't say that.
Now, I think the statute does say that.
That was my question. That was my point.
So any citizen who operates his business can be a
statute
identifying. Can be a contractor on the basis that they're economically disadvantaged.
Yes, and that's the way the administrator interpreted it. You weren't testifying to the records until the way
you bought records. How do you define economically disadvantaged?
Depending upon administrative rules and remedies, and that's what you tell the court. Hernandez says you've got to define it.
So if you're not making as much money, you might be making your economically disadvantaged in your
I think there would be broader than that, but that's not our challenge today.
It seems like nonsense. I mean, it seems to me you're pushing this definition to the point that you're saying you declare it constitutional. But define it in such a way that the whole statute is meaningful.
Well, we have two guidelines for economic disadvantage. One is the ODOT program. Our Department of Transportation follows exactly that standard. So I'm not making this up. That's the way they administer the program.
Well, that's what that's done.
Well, maybe we're not able to determine that. And second, the United States Supreme Court in the Adirondacks said exactly this. It says that you can use rates merely for a logical assumption, though, to show economic disadvantage.
Should it be the other way around? Right? If you use rates qualified, and then you're not economically disadvantaged,
I think that could be the way.
That's what they said.
I think the legislature could advise it in that way. And that is not the way it's been administered. That's not the way
it can't be said to be, right? That might be
well, possibly. What this administrator did, that is the sole issue for debate today, is just the opposite. She said, if you don't fit anything in the way I define Oriental, you're out.
Yeah. That's the real beef is, he was in and now he's back.
It was arbitrary reversal based only on race.
But if he didn't belong in it at all, then how was that constitutional issue?
Well, that assumption is twofold. One, is he Oriental, which we believe he is, and two, is he economically disadvantaged, which we believe he is, and the administrator did not consider either of those factors. And that's why the civil rights violated. She said he doesn't fit racially, and that violates the civil rights.
And he doesn't fit racially under the whole umbrella that supports even having such a statute, which is a compelling state interest in remedying past discrimination against the classifications that support that legislation. I mean, we know, you know, it's circular. You have to be of that race or the classifications that support having any sort of suspect kind of classification, such as race.
If you beg the question and go back to compelling interest, which was not briefed or debated in it, because we believe that the predicate is there, then you do start raising those issues. Now, the trial court raised this point. Now, I think that the paragraph is conclusive on that, because if you open that up, that issue, then you question how anyone can be Oriental or anyone can be Black. Based on percentages, if they had a one-point parent, or we can go into that forever.
That's responded to by there is a doctrine and a maxim in Ohio law that we allow agencies and to come up with their own definitions, to construe their own definitions, short of some really arbitrary behavior, which, but you say this is, but that, it's how arbitrary can it be with Oriental?
Well, the judge Hogan stated as follows. This court can think of a few things more repugnant to our constitutional system of government than the construction of the statute, that's the administrator's definition,
right,
that would exclude a group of United States citizens and residents of Ohio from a state program, the sole criteria of which the exclusion being the site of a river, a mountain range, or a desert their ancestors decided to settle.
But that's his judgment. The General Assembly obviously decided, I mean, we have to assume the General Assembly decided that there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 groups that are economically disadvantaged. And it said so in the statute. They said they're Black, American Indians, Hispanics, and Oriental. And so why should a trial judge say, well, I don't agree with you. I look over mountain ranges. That's ridiculous. I mean, the General Assembly makes those decisions, doesn't it?
The General Assembly did not define it.
Well, right. So we have to define it. But you're saying you're trying to bring in anybody who's just economically disadvantaged, and the General Assembly has said these are the four groups of ethnic groups that we believe are economically disadvantaged, and we're going to give them this benefit.
I don't think
we are bound by Booker Tall, are we?
No, but it's arbitrary and capricious for another administrator later to just say, well, now you're out. And that's the fact. There was nothing in law or fact to change, and that's why the civil rights were violated. Her sole basis was, if we don't agree with that definition, we've got another dictionary. So we have asked, again, to repeat the conclusion. We believe that both the Graham and this appellate decision hold that Ritchie's right, civil rights were violated because he used on race per se, that the statute is upheld but not applied constitutionally unless he is raised as only a presumption, and so that if he presumes or in that instance, Ritchie also must be presumed in. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Liggett. Ms. French, you used your time, but 30 seconds.
Thank you.
case is submitted, you'll be advised of our opinion. The council may hear its views. We have another matter.
Okay.